I have the distinct honor today to introduce one of the most distinguished members of our fold, Dr. Jack Hislop. More than 10 years ago, I had the honor of introducing Jack to a very large public audience. Swami had instructed the American Psi Organization to sponsor a series of public meetings in American cities in order to speak about spiritual truth. One of these meetings was held in New York. It was in a large theater on Broadway with a capacity of 2,500, and every seat was filled. At that meeting, I introduced Jack very briefly, and I'd like to share that introduction with you right now. I said to the audience, "The man whom I'm about to introduce is the father of the Satya Sai Baba movement in America. Dr. John Hislop earned his doctorate of education at UCLA and subsequently served as the chairman of business education at Riverside College. He is the author of a book entitled Conversations with Satya Sai Baba. He was the co-founder of the Satya Sai Baba Council of America in 1975. Most importantly, he has been the steadfast, faithful leader whose strength and dedication over the years has kept people true to their cause. Jack then spoke, and he touched the hearts of the people. As most of you know, Jack Hislop writes well, he speaks well, and he knows the divine teachings of Bhagavan Sri Satya Sai Baba as well as anyone in the world. His books are a wonderful introduction for anyone to the universal and loving message of our master. But these are not Jack's most important qualifications. He is eminently qualified to speak to us because of his extensive spiritual experience and because he lives what he learns. A few years ago, Jack and I were together in India with Swami. Swami called upon Jack to speak to the students. After he spoke, Swami said to the group, "Hislop has much experience." At a very young and tender age, Jack Hislop decided that God realization was the only valid purpose in life, and he has had the courage and determination to act upon this conviction. Over the years, he has had many uplifting spiritual experiences. Fortunately for him and for us, his quest has culminated at the divine lotus feet of our beloved Swami. Jack Hislop's knowledge and understanding of Swami's teachings is profound, and his dedication and single-mindedness in applying this knowledge and understanding to his own life is immediately evident to anyone who knows him. This is what touches our hearts, and this is what constitutes Jack Hislop's greatness. It is indeed my honor and joy to introduce my old friend, with whom I have occasionally disagreed, but never cease to respect, admire, and love. I give you Dr. Jack Hislop.
I heard Mike's introduction just as you did, and I can assure you I can't live up to his introduction. That's impossible. Perhaps I should start. So many stories. I could keep you here until 10 o'clock tonight and never reach the end of the fascinating stories about Swami. But I think I should start off with one story that you can take home and enjoy telling to your children. In the recent New Zealand conference, which was held in that very hilly mountainous city of Wellington, there were many children there. And seeing the children, I thought they would enjoy the angel story, so I told them. And then after the meeting, they and various adults came up and told me that they saw the angels on the stage. and there was Swami there too. So I have to suspect that as enthusiasm, and I don't anticipate that you will see the angels here on the stage. But when Swami was a very young man, before he really started on his world mission, he would stay with a hostess in Bangalore, come down from Puttaparthi. And there was also a favorite hostess in Madras. And in those days, people hadn't been giving Swamis Mercedes and Rolls Royces and so on. When I first was there, all he had was an old second-hand Chevrolet station wagon given to him by Bob Raymer. And in that station wagon, we made a trip with him to Madras. But in those early days, Swami would drive his own car, and he would drive to Madras by himself. And when the devotees there would hear that Swami was going to Madras, they would line up or sort of find posts of observation along the roadway. Because when Swami would come in his car at a very good rate of speed, he would be sitting behind the wheel like this. And the car was buzzing along. And even more than that, the people told that the car was about that far above the ground. And many people have told me about those experiences, so I'm inclined to believe that they must be actual. Well, at any rate, one time Swami went like this to Madras and went up to the door of the hostess. And she came to the door and said, "Oh, Swami, Swami, I'm so happy to see you. But Swami, you didn't tell me you were coming, and I haven't the things ready." You know, in India, when the Lord visits a house, the lady of the house feels she must have flowers and fruit and the proper things to make a correct offering to the distinguished visitor. And she didn't have any of these, so she really felt quite badly. So Swami said, "Don't worry, don't worry." Then he turned to the car and beckoned like that. And out of the car stepped two angels with wings. And they were carrying a great big silver tray completely loaded with all of the things that the hostess needed to properly welcome Swami. And the angels handed the tray to the hostess, and then Swami made a motion like that, and they went back to the car and disappeared. Now, this story came to light some years later when somebody had given Swami a bus, and so then he started to take some students with him in the bus wherever he went. And on this occasion, the second-hand bus somebody had given to Swami was filled with students, and they went to the house of the hostess first because the students would stay someplace else and they would let Swami get off. Well, when the hostess saw the students, she went back into the room, into the house, and brought out a big silver tray, the very silver tray that the angels had given her, and she told this whole story to the students. So that's how the rest of us came to know the story of the angels. And I think that your children will enjoy that story if you tell it to them. Now, all of us are here in this room, and around us in this neighborhood are thousands, hundreds of thousands of very good people, very good ladies, very good men, and they aren't here. So why are you here? What is it that brings those of us who are here? What brings us here? People in general tend to undervalue themselves. And I want to point out to you how really great you are. You know, Swami said that if you choose a regular worldly person, and he's willing to sit down and listen to you, and you explain to him in detail and very carefully about spiritual life, the practice of spiritual life, and the results of spiritual life, he said, that person won't understand even one word of what you are saying. So Swami has said that those come to him, only those whom he has called. Nobody comes to see Swami unless Swami has called that person to him. I said to Swami, well, Swami, why are those people called? And he said that in the distant past, they have engaged in very good deeds and in spiritual practice, and they have thereby established a savings account of merit. And when I call them to me, then they draw on that savings account of merit for the trip here to see me. So, there isn't a person sitting in this room who, despite his present station in life and his present calling in life, there isn't a person who hasn't had a very, very significant life or lives in the past. Every one of you here, I'm sure in past ages, has been a yogi again and again, a spiritual aspirant, a devotee, a disciple of great people. So, you are not ordinary people. And it's a mistake for you to say that I'm just an ordinary person. I really can't understand what Swami is saying. I really don't know how to put into practice what Swami is saying. Those are false statements dreamed up by the mind. Now, what all of us want, I believe, from talking to so many people over the years, all of us would like to experience in his own life that which Swami is constantly experiencing. He says, I am always in bliss. You cannot know how happy I am. I don't know what worry and trouble means. They have no meaning to me at all. So we think of that as self-realization, as liberation. So at the depth of our being, we know that there is a state of being that is joyful and happy, and we are aiming at achieving that state of happiness. So the question then arises, how do we do that? How in our daily lives can we do the things that are necessary to open our hearts, to open our minds, that are necessary for us to reach the fruition of human life? Self-realization, liberation, returning to the source. Now, because of the many books that are printed and the many things that are said, there are so many ideas floating around and so much conversation that it's sometimes hard to know exactly what we should be doing. And there are things that we should be doing. If we sincerely want liberation, then should we not be thinking of that every moment of the day? If we want a career on the stage, or a career of any sort, or we fall in love with somebody, we are constantly thinking of that career, or of the person whom we love. There is an intensity there. So I asked Swami, why is it, Swami, that all of your devotees read your books and meet together, and what is the principal thing that prevents us, your devotees, from achieving the goal of life, which is liberation or self-knowledge or the realization that we were never bound at any time whatsoever? Swami said, the principal reason is lack of intensity. That is, we are not giving our hearts and our minds every moment of the day to that goal, to achieving our purpose. He said, that is the principal reason. And as you know, in one of his talks, which was published not too long ago, he mentioned that his American devotees are very good people. They do good seva, and they sing beautiful bhajans, but they don't know anything about spiritual life. So, is spiritual life that difficult? Is it so hard to understand Swami and know what to do? No, not at all. Swami said that if you wish to cross this distance that you now believe exists between you and liberation, then there are two ways, two principal pathways to cross that so-called no man's land to the goal of liberation. One is called the path of wisdom, and the other is called the path of devotion. The path of wisdom, Swami likens to a small monkey and its mother. If the mother goes any place and the little monkey doesn't want to be abandoned and left behind, it has to jump on mother's back and grab her fur and hold on for dear life. Otherwise, it falls off and is left behind and is gone. Whereas the path of devotion is like the mother kitten and the mother cat and the little kitten. If the mother cat goes someplace, she picks up the little kitten and carries it. The kitten doesn't have to worry at all. The kitten doesn't have to do anything for himself or herself. The mother does everything. And Swami likens that to the path of devotion. Now, he recommends the path of devotion as being the easiest way across this no man's land of samsara, or worldly life. And so does Krishna recommend the path of devotion as the easiest and the fastest way. You may remember that quite a few years ago, Swami asked his devotees to memorize the 10th chapter in the Bhagavad Gita because of the conversation between Lord Krishna and Arjuna. Because Arjuna asked that very question. He said, of those who love you as the Lord of love, ever-present everywhere, and knowing the transcendental existence, which way is sure and swift, love or knowledge? And then Krishna replied that for those who set their hearts on me and meditate on me with single-hearted devotion, the way of love leads sure and swift to me. And then later on he said that those for whom I am the goal supreme, who do all work renouncing self for me and meditate on me with single-hearted devotion, these will I swiftly rescue from the cycle of birth and death to fullness of eternal life in me. Still your mind in me, still yourself in me, and without doubt you shall be united with me, Lord of love, dwelling in your heart. So, Baba and Krishna both recommend the path of devotion in this Kali Yuga. But you will have noticed that in recent discourses, Swami has said to us, his devotees, now you are in college. You have passed through the grade schools. Now you're in college and you must give some attention to college subjects. College subjects being those topics dealt with on the path of wisdom. And so if you've noticed, recently in talks, although he talks mostly devotion, sometimes he'll give a very striking and penetrating statement and paragraph on the path of wisdom. Now, Adi Shankara, you've heard his name many times. In fact, the boys at the college every year practice and give a play based on the teachings of Adi Shankara, who lived in the 5th century and died at the age of 32, but really transformed the philosophical face of India in those few years. And he said that the self-knowledge plus detachment gains the kingdom of deliverance. Self-knowledge plus detachment. So the principal topic in the path of wisdom is detachment. That is, to not be caught up in the circumstances that are happening in your life or in the life of other people. That is to be a witness, not a participant. Like two people are engaged in a quarrel, and the witness stands off to one side and doesn't participate in the quarrel, either in the blows or the talk. So he is the witness. He is detached from that those circumstances. Being detached, he doesn't get involved, doesn't engage in actions which have their results in the future, and chain him further to the world, the life of samsara, the life of the world. Now, so Swami says that now we're in college, and then we must now, in addition to devotion, start to practice some of the things on the path of wisdom. And the principal item on the path of wisdom is detachment. That is, Swami has told us, as have the other sages of ancient Indian history, that the self, the Atma, is alone. That is, there is no duality. Everything that smacks of duality is false. That there is one and one only, and that is God. Now, so our task on the path of wisdom is to detach ourselves from being so involved in our daily experiences and start to inquire within to see if there is some aspect of oneself which is free from, apart from, all of the changing facets of the world. Now that is, if one is going to find his true self, which Swami says is always liberation, that when liberation occurs, nothing is gained. The one simply realizes he was never bound, never in ignorance. So therefore, our journey within is to find that state of being within ourselves, which never changes, never alters, is universal, omnipresent, and exists always without change. That is the task of self-inquiry. And that is done by stepping backward. Neti, neti, not this, not this, not this. As I am not this, I am not this, I am not this. Now, let us do a very simple experiment to show you how easy it is to begin this step backward to the source. Because Swami tells us that it's worldly life that's difficult. Spiritual life is easy. Worldly life is hard and difficult. Now, as each of you is sitting there, you are aware. That is, you're aware of the person beside you, aware even of the person who's sitting behind you, aware of myself here on the platform, aware of the walls, aware of the lamps, aware of what is being said. Now, I noticed one man there was holding his chin like this, and then he put it down on his lap. Now, that was an experience. It could have been anything. He could have been badly injured. He could even have been killed or become very ill, or some radical change could have occurred. But when the man made that change, was his awareness affected? He was aware of the change. He continues to be aware of everything happening around him. So while there was a change in the body and in the mind even, there was no change in his awareness. I see some man there moved his head like that. That was an experience. It could have been anything. But was his awareness of himself and of the people in the room and the stage and the lights and so on changed? Not a bit. I hope you're conducting that experiment right now. So you see, there is something in your very everyday life which is apart from all the experiences that you go through during the day, miserable, happy, unfortunate, or whatever they may be. There is an aspect of yourself which is quite separated from that, which is not affected by, and which is not changed by anything that happens in the world of experience. Now, if you have done that, then you already know that it's possible to step back from experience to an aspect of yourself which is free of experience, which persists unchanged despite the changes in experience. Now, that is called detachment, self-inquiry. So then, this awareness that is in this room, is that different from the awareness of Swami himself, of Baba himself? No, it's not. Now, I'll tell you how I know that. Several years ago, you know, when they have these discourses in the mornings at Prasanthi Nilayam for the foreigners, to keep the foreigners off the streets. They start about 11 o'clock in one of the lecture halls, and I always get tapped to give some talks. So, a couple of years ago, I gave a series of 5 talks. And then the people wanted a question and answer session. So we arranged that. Now, at that time, I was sitting at the very front of the veranda, and Swami was calling in Narasimham. Narasimham is the editor of Sanatana Sarathi. Calling Narasimham in every morning to talk to him about Sanatana Sarathi. And since I was sitting up in front, Swami would call me in at the same time as Narasimham. So, after the question and answer session, as usual, I went into the room in the morning. And Swami said to me, Hislop, at that session you did nothing but confuse the people. So I said, Swami, what do you mean? And he said, well, they would ask questions, and you, instead of answering in terms of Swami's teachings, would answer in terms of Vedanta, which they didn't understand, and on the basis of their non-understanding, they would ask further questions. So there was nothing but confusion. So I said, Swami, this is a small room. There's just that one window there. Most of you have been to Prasanthi Nilayam. You know his little room, his office, with a door on the veranda and one little window to the side. And I said, there's that one little window, and the lecture hall is a long ways away, Swami. So, how did you know what I was saying and what they were saying? Swami said, Hislop, don't you know that God has 1,000 eyes and 1,000 ears? Well, I said, yes, Swami, I've heard that. But Swami, how were you there? Were you there as God, as Ishvara? Swami said, no, Hislop. I was there as omnipresent awareness. That is, just as you are aware now of the person sitting beside you and the person sitting behind you, Swami, in his omnipresent awareness, which is precisely the same as the awareness that you now experience, but his is omnipresent, not bound by mind or by body or by any factor whatsoever. So, if you can, perhaps when you leave, dwell with an experiment on seeing if you can't step aside from your body and from your engagement in the world and become aware of some aspect of yourself which remains untouched despite what has happened to you in terms of experience. Because if we want to find our true self, then obviously that has to be the most esoteric, the ultimate inner aspect of ourselves that never changes. We can't say that I'm this body which changes, and we identify ourselves as other things, my car. We can't say that car is me because it changes. We say my, I am separate from the car. My body, I am separate from the body. My mind, I am separate from the mind. My soul, I am separate from the soul. So, Swami's stricture to us then is, on this path of wisdom which we must now pay attention to, according to what Swami has told us, that we start with practicing detachment, with the objective of looking deep within ourselves and finding that which never changes, that which is Swami's omnipresent awareness, that which is divine. Because Swami tells us that we are divine. Now, we all know his well-publicized statement, I am God, yes, but so are you. The only difference between us being that I know it and you don't know it. Now, some people in the media world pick up that statement and say, here's this man in India claims he's God. But Swami never stops in the middle of that sentence. He always continues and says, and so are you God. The only difference between us being that I know it and you do not know it. Now, we want to know. We think that Swami is God. We behave as though Swami is God. But how do we know that? Swami is God. So therefore we give him our allegiance. We surrender to him. We do everything in life that he asks us to do. All with the undercurrent that we want to be free of this limited human life and be one with the unlimited divine. Now, we say, well, Swami does all of these miracles. But does that prove he's God? That just proves that he's a good yogi. He says all these wonderful things. Does that prove he's God? That just proves that he's a good philosopher. He does all these wonderful seva projects. Does that prove he's God? That only says he's a big-hearted human person. So then how are we going to find out the truth of the matter? Is Swami God or is he not God? There we must look at the second aspect of that formula, where Swami says, yes, I am God, but so are you. The only difference being that I know it and you don't know it. So if we wish to approach Swami as God and be united with Swami as God, then we must look at ourselves and find out that we are God, as Swami has told us we are. Once we know that we are God, then certainly we will know whether or not Swami is God. And of course, in my deepest estimation, that is precisely what we will find. Now, in briefly reciting the discourse between Arjuna and Krishna, at the end, Krishna told Arjuna to rest your mind in me. And you will be united with me, Lord of love dwelling in your heart. Right now, when I first saw Swami, the very first day that I saw Swami, 25 years ago, January 1968, there were no new buildings. Nothing was there. Just some old buildings in the old mandir. There were only some 8 foreigners on the campus, and probably less than 40 Indian devotees. That's all that were there. So they put the ladies of the party, there were some 8 or 10 of us, ladies of the party one room, the men on the other, and then they came and said, all gather in this one room because Swami is going to come and see you and talk to you. So we all went into the one room, expecting a lot, of course, because we'd heard all of these wonderful stories about Swami. So Swami came in. Mind you, he was 25 years younger then than he is now, too. And although he's very agile and graceful still, at that time he was in the very flower of his youth. And beautiful. He just glided across the floor, didn't walk. And such a lovely big smile and great big lustrous eyes and that soft musical voice. And sitting there looking at that with fascination, I lost worldly consciousness, and the world disappeared entirely. And I had been complaining, as had others of my friends, that I had a dry Western heart. No love in the heart, just a dry Western heart. And so I disappeared. The world disappeared. And only Swami was there. It's all I could see. Then I felt a movement in my heart. A very faint movement, like maybe I describe it as the breeze from a butterfly's wings. Very subtle. And then I realized that movement is the movement of love in this dry Western heart. And then I realized, so that is Satya Sai Baba himself in my heart as love. And I said to myself, how could it be that a stranger can come uninvited into my heart? Who could that be? Only God can do that. So therefore, the conviction descended on me immediately that Swami was God. And from that direct experience of the Swami in my heart, dwelling in my heart, I know him as God, no matter what anyone says. But nevertheless, I am also busy doing exactly what I'm telling you to do. And you will know that I am the Lord of love dwelling in your heart. So, along with that devotion, now we must start to practice the path of wisdom. I've said enough about the path of wisdom to get you started on that path. Now, basically, in the path of wisdom, I must say this too. Basically, in the path of wisdom, it means that we must wake up. We must wake up from the dream. Now, last night, for example, I had a dream. And I was fully involved in the actions and the personalities and the dangers of that dream. Fully involved, just as I'm involved now in this room here, sitting here with you. And I had to take ordinary common sense actions to survive in that dream world. myself as a dream person. Now, in order to get liberated from that dream world in which I was caught, what was necessary? I had to wake up, didn't I? I had to wake up from the dream. That was the only way that I could get liberated from being caught in this dream world, to wake up from the dream. Now, likewise, Swami and all the great sages of history tell us, of Indian history, Vedanta, that although this waking world is a very long term of existence in relation to the brief sleeping dream, yet this waking world is also a dream. In the sleeping dream, after I wake up and am free from it, then I can see that every person, every item, every mountain, every house, everything in that dream world was just my own mind, wasn't it? There wasn't any house there really. There weren't any people there really. There was just all thoughts in my mind, which I projected outward as the dream world. Is that right? That's right. And I couldn't see that until I got wakened up. So likewise, in this waking world, which Swami calls a waking dream, how am I going to get liberated from this long dream? Surely only by waking up from the dream. What does it matter what I do in the dream? Meditate, seva, change the world. All I'm doing is changing the dream within the dream. It doesn't amount to anything. The only thing that is real that counts for anything is to wake up from the dream. Then you can see and visualize and judge the world that you've been caught up in. And I said to Swami one time, Swami, you say this world is just a long dream. But we see you, Swami, in this dream, working like mad night and day. How is that? If it's just a dream. Swami said, Hislop, I come into your dream to help you wake up. Therefore, we have to wake up from this dream and know ourselves as we really are. That is the divine aspect, unlimited potential, universal awareness. That is our goal. And for that, we have to wake up. And Swami is telling us, he's in this dream to help us wake up. He's telling us how to wake up. And he says the two ways, the two principal ways to wake up is through the path of wisdom, where you put everything aside that's false and finally know that you're real self without any hesitation or mystery whatsoever. And the other way is to be devoted to God. Devotion to God means merging with God. The other way is merging with God. And he tells us, just as in the path of devotion, he tells us how to find the truth and awaken from the dream. Likewise, in the path of devotion, that way, he tells us the truth and how to awaken from this long, long dream. He says, it's best to choose personal God. You want to be united with God, to merge in God, to be like the kitten that holds always to its mother and is carried safely to the destination. So he said, it's best to choose personal God, because if you think of God as just God in the abstract, then how can you feel love and affection for just an abstract idea? There has to be a person, a personal God. So he said, choose as your personal God that form and that name which is dearest to you, which is dearest to your heart. For my case, it's Satya Sai Baba. For your case, it may be Sri Krishna or Sri Rama or Lord Jesus Christ. Swami says to choose as personal God that name and form that is dearest to your heart. And then love that personal God so much, more and more and more and more, until then you see him every place you look. Then you've made the transition from personal God to universal God. Now, how can you see the Lord every place you look? Again, Swami tells us so clearly how to do that. He says that the principal obstacle that keeps us caught up in this dream world is the mind, the working of the mind. Thoughts occur in the mind and they're projected outward as reality. Thoughts in the mind interfere all the time with what you want to do. Now, if you really want to love God, how do you learn to love anybody? If you have an acquaintance and who's a personable, likable person, you start to see that acquaintance every day, you meet him every day, you talk to him, you have lunch with him, you go to the movies with him, you invite him to your house. That familiarity soon turns into love. I ask Swami, Swami, I know that love for God must be in my heart someplace, but I don't find it. Where is it, Swami? Swami said, Hislop, it's very simple. He said, now that tape recorder that you're lugging around with you all the time, he said, when you saw that in the shop window, you didn't feel any love for it. But once you bought it and became yours, you love it dearly. You take it with you every place you go. So therefore, the way to love God is to take him as yours. He's yours. He's your companion, your constant companion. You think of him all the time. You walk hand in hand with him. He's in the car with you. He's here beside you now. So, if you start then to have God in your company and in your life all the time, then you find a tremendous love arising in your heart for God. And that is the great connection between ourselves as mortals and divinity as God, is that love for God. Now, Swami said recently that the fast way, the very, very fast way to union with God is to have him in your mind always. Now, what do we mean with union with God? You know, they were building the museum at Prasanthi Nilayam, you know, and the roof caved in and killed two or three people. You remember that? A few years ago. See, Swami said that don't grieve for those people. They merged with me. They merged with God. And then Mr. Suri, who runs the bookstore and the publishing, his son was going from Prasanthi Nilayam to Bangalore to some meeting. And the van had a wreck. And the boy was mortally injured. And Suri said to Swami, Swami, save my son. Save my son, Swami. And Swami said, but there's a problem. You say, save your son, and your son says, Lord, I wish to merge with you. And so then, a light came, clearly visible to Suri and to the other people in the party. A light came out of the boy, out of his chest area, I believe it was. A bright light, and went into the feet of Sai. He merged with Sai. So, merging with God means becoming God, being God, not different from God. You are God and God is you. As Jesus said, my Father is in me and I am in my Father. Whosoever sees me sees the Father. So, the fast way then of merging with God is to always keep God in mind. How could that be true? It's true for this reason. The only reality is God. Everything else is thought produced. only reality is God. Therefore, the idea of a division between me and God is a false idea. It's based on delusion or on illusion. Now, if I think of God, I think of God in this particular moment, don't I? Moment by moment by moment, I think of God. Now, what is this moment? This moment is life. The past moment is just memory. The future moment is just surmise. The only reality, with all the power of divinity, all the power of creation, is in this moment, right now, this split second. So when we think of God all the time, we are thinking of God split second by split second. And the power of our thought in that split second is far more powerful than the power of the illusion that seems to separate us from God. So thinking of God all the time, that illusion falls away, and when we know ourselves as the divine, as God himself, that is the fastest way to union with God, according to what Swami now tells us. And why don't you do that? Why don't we do that? Why do we allow other ideas and concerns and interests to enter our mind? It's because we don't have enough intensity. We're not really focused on that yet. Why? Because we don't really understand it. We haven't tasted it. Swami tells us how to taste it. Now, think of God all the time. But how can you do that? Because your mind wanders here and wanders there and wanders every place. But there is a way that the mind can be controlled. A very easy way, which has been used for time immemorial, which Swami strongly advises, and that is the recitation of the name of God. Constant recitation of the name of God. Now, how can you always recite the name of God? That means it must compete with other thoughts and other interests. So Swami tells the story of the king of ancient times who had a vast kingdom. And his kingdom was going to pots because his executives, his administrators, weren't doing their job properly. And so the king prayed to God. And God appeared and said, well, what do you want? And the king said, oh Lord, I need a good servant. My kingdom is falling to pieces. My servants are neglecting their work. So God said, very well, I will send you a good servant, but I also give you a warning. Unless you keep that servant busy, he will turn upon you and kill you. Well, my king thought, my God, I have all this kingdom and so much trouble. I don't need to worry about that. Let the man go to work. So the servant went to work. And before long, the king realized with a start that the servant was so efficient that he almost finished all the work of the kingdom. And so then he remembered what God had warned him about, and he prayed to God again. And God appeared and said, well, what do you want this time? So the king said, oh Lord, my servant is almost finished with his work, then he will turn upon me, as you said, O Lord, and he will destroy me. He will destroy me, Lord. Help me, help me, help me. So the Lord said, very well, I will help you once again. Now do this. When the servant has finished his work and comes to you, you have him build a brick wall 40 feet tall, brick by brick, 40 feet tall. And then you have the servant climb up that wall and down that wall and up that wall and down that wall as his work until you have some constructive work for him to do. Then put him to work, and the moment he finishes that work, then put him to climbing the wall again, because otherwise he will destroy you. So Swami says to choose a name that is dear to us. I choose Om Sai Ram, Om Sai Ram. I repeat it all the time. I repeat it so long now. It's automatic. It goes on by itself all the time. Om Sai Ram, Om Sai Ram, Om Sai Ram, Om Sai Ram. In the Western world, it had a beginning about 16 years after the death of Christ. Christ had taught the recitation of the name to his disciples. And about 16 years after his death, the preceptors of that time, some of the preceptors of that time, started to teach the recitation of the name to their students. And it spread all over Europe and throughout all the Middle Ages and the Early Ages. Pilgrims would wander through the forests from one monastery to the other, reciting all the time God's name. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. With the objective of making it permanent and automatic in the heart. Sometimes they would time the saying with their breath, sometimes with their step, sometimes with the pulse beat. There's that famous book, which is available every place now, a very small book, called The Way of the Pilgrim by French, which is a translation of a diary kept by one of these wandering monks who recited God's name all the time. The miracles that happened in that man's life just by reciting God's name is simply fantastic. So therefore, Swami says, if you don't keep the servant busy, he will destroy you. Now, that's our case. That's why we aren't already, me included, enjoying that wonderful state that Swami is enjoying, moment by moment, always. And that is that the mind... Now, Swami said, the mind does have good work. Its work is to plan and execute the plan. That is, to do our daily work, whatever that work may be. But as soon as the work is finished, and the moment that you catch your mind starting to wander, oh, she said that, and I didn't like that. And my neighbor should have better sense than to turn his TV up that loud, 12 o'clock at night. Or all these thoughts start to wander through your mind. Those thoughts destroy you. They keep you bound. And Swami tells us, at the very moment that in your mind, work having been finished, your mind starts to wander on all these foolish imaginations and memories and projections, put it to work reciting God's name. If you do that, you are automatically controlling the mind. And in no time at all, according to Swami, you will be able to dive deep into yourself and start to make some very startling discoveries. And moreover, you can think of Swami all the time. The fast way to merging with God is to think of him all the time. You recite his name all the time, but you're not engaged in legitimate work for the mind, and that takes you to the Lord. Now, so of all of Swami's teachings then, the most important of all the teachings is Swami himself. Because it is Swami representing the divine, being the divine, being the omnipresent consciousness, the omnipresent awareness. Sat Chit Ananda, being, awareness, bliss. That is the existence of Swami. That's not a description of Swami. That is Swami. Sat Chit Ananda, being, awareness, bliss. And that is our goal. That's what drove us into spiritual life over all the past incarnations that we've gone through. And believe me, you have done that. That's what drove us into spiritual life. That's what brings us to this meeting now. Whether we recognize it overtly in our mind, that's the underlying push, the underlying drive. And it's so easy. Swami says, dedicate every action to me.
and then do the action in a way that will please me. So, you can think of him all the time, because no matter what you do, dedicate that action to Swami, and then do the action in a way that will please Swami. What could be easier? Your mind is on Swami all of the time, in that way. What is sadhana, spiritual sadhana? Spiritual sadhana is how you live your daily life, day by day, hour by hour. Another way to think of Swami all the time is to hold his hand all the time. That is, since he is omnipresent awareness here and there and here and there and every place at all times, when you awaken in the morning, he is there beside your bed in that space. So when you awaken, visualize Swami. Visualization is easy. There isn't a lady here who can't easily visualize the face of her mother and of her child. And there isn't a man here who can't visualize the car that he drove to get here. So, visualization is easy. So when you awaken in the morning, create Swami, create his hair, create his forehead, create his nose, create his mouth, create his shoulders, then his long red robe, orange robe. Then take him by the hand and hold his hand all day long. Mind you, if you have to go to the bathroom, you can say, Swami, please wait for me until I come out. But hold his hand. Take him to work with you. But then you say to Swami, Swami, how can I think of you when I'm supposed to work? I'll get fired. So Swami said, no, no. He said, when you are at work, concentrate 100% on what you are doing. And Swami is at the very point of that concentration, just as much with you as when you are walking on the street hand in hand. And what is the great advantage of walking hand in hand with Swami all day long? You know, all of us have bad characteristics developed over the past ages. Jealousy, hatred, heavens knows, any one of those troubles that takes you to a psychiatrist and you ask him to give you a new feeling instead of that old feeling, he does, and that comes out worse than what you had before. So, you do that. You take him by the hand. Now, Swami is the sun of life, the glorious shining sun. All of these bad characteristics that are dealt with by psychiatrists and also by physicians and also by the other members of your family, all these bad characteristics, they are all flowers of the night. They grow in the darkness, they grow in ignorance, they grow in delusion. They're flowers of the night. And when you walk hand in hand with Swami, who is the glorious blazing sun of truth, these flowers of the night cannot continue, they cannot survive in the sun of the Lord. So therefore, one by one they fall away and drop off, without your having to go to a psychiatrist, without your having to do anything about those bad characteristics, they just disappear. I tell you, with what modesty I can, that I did that. I do that. And I, for the life of me, I can't bring up jealousy or anger or hatred or any of these despicable things that lead to such terrible actions in the world. Solely because I walk hand in hand with Swami. They cannot survive. So therefore, when you're walking to, and you see another person, you know that the only reality of that person is God, because only God exists. Everything else is illusion. So therefore you know that in the illusion of this person, created by my mind, that which is real in the person is God, only God. So therefore, when you see another person, in your heart, in your own mind, you salute God. Dearest Lord, I love you. If you do that, a wave of happiness will flash across your heart. You don't tell the person. That's a secret between you and God. You treat the person according to their work and their status, just as you do now. But you see God in the person. Now, all these things that I have described to you, three or four in the recent few minutes, they're all so easy to do. Swami said, spiritual life is easy. So easy to do those things. Why not do them? Why not resolve now that you will lead a spiritual life, not just by coming to the occasional meeting or when you sit down to meditate, but all day long in every action that you do, lead a spiritual life. Hold to God, see God, realize His presence, knowing that He is your truth, that you yourself are God, nothing else exists, and you wish to get rid of all the illusion that makes you think otherwise. And Swami says, think of me always, think of me always. You remember the story of the two guardians of heaven who committed some misdemeanor and they were kicked out of heaven and wanted to come back. And the Lord of heaven said, well, you can have your choice. 18 incarnations as devotees of God or 2 incarnations as enemies of God. Which one do you think they chose? Well, they weren't stupid, even though they'd done some bad things. They chose to be enemies of God. Why? Because Swami said, my devotees think of me occasionally, but my enemies think of me all the time. So as enemies of God, they think of God all the time, and therefore the delusion which separates them from God disappears, and they realize themselves as the divine. So easy. Dedicate every action to God, no matter what it is. And then do the action in a way that pleases God. What's so hard about that? Repeat God's name. And when your mind starts to wander off in all the foolishness that only you know it has, don't continue with the foolishness. Start to recite God's name. And you'll be thinking of God all the time. Walk with Him. Have a seat for Him in your car. Have a chair for Him in your home. Think of Him all the time. Hold to Him. Let Him be your Lord, your Guru, your all. And Swami says that that is the way to realization of the human goal, which is to be united with the Source, to return to the Source. Now you don't have to go out and persuade other people to do that. This is between you and God. Other people, Swami has said that the goal of humanity is union with the Source from which they came. He said that every man may stumble 100 times and fall in the mud and the slime, but he will rise again and go forward and finally merge in his Source. So these other people, whom you look at with askance, doing that, they're a little slower than us is all. In good time, they also will do that very thing that we are now going to do. They have to. It's human destiny. So I hope, sincerely hope, that you'll take 2 or 3 of these points to heart and do that which will please Swami. That is, think of Him all the time and unite with Him. Be one with Him. Realize your own divinity and shed light to all the world. Because since you are not separate from others, when you illuminate yourself, then you do the greatest service to all the others, because the others are not different from you. They share in that. So now I think, before they stop me forcefully, I better stop voluntarily and say thank you very much for listening to me. Oh, Bob says we have time for some questions if you'd like to ask.
Her question base is, why is it that Dr. Hislop said that I am separate from my soul?
Swami said, who is this I that is limited to the body, but is separate from the body? Limited to the body, but separate from the body. He said there is no soul other than that. And that surpassed only the Absolute exists. Swami, in referring to Himself, said that except for this form, and name. This is the absolute only.
Another question is that Swami says to pray to merge with me. But as I understand his question, will this take me away from what I'm doing today?
Okay. So, when you are engaged in work, then you must do that work with the full heart and the full responsibility. That is, as long as you are caught up in the dream, you have to respect the limitations of the dream. For example, you can't say this world is unreal and step in front of a moving car, because regardless of what you think, you're going to be injured. But, see, our problem is that we're not distinguishing being, that is, I am aware, there is this awareness. We're not distinguishing being from the process of experience. Now, the gentleman says that in terms of experience, he must do his duty, and how can he think of God only in such a case as that? See, here comes an aspect of the path of wisdom, which may indeed give you some trouble to understand. But nevertheless, I will say it and let us see. See, all this, we waken in the morning, and then the world appears. And then we are engaged all day long in interaction with the world and with its objects. And we identify with the body and say, it is I who am having those experiences. And it is I who have the responsibility for them. See, Swami tells us, just very recently, that this world of experience that is coming to this meeting, perhaps having a tummy ache from eating too much, perhaps having a quarrel with son or daughter or neighbors, perhaps a war, perhaps a hurricane, killing many people. See, all this is the current, the river of life. All this is the product of nature, like rain and wind and hurricanes and earthquakes. You see, the physical world, the world in which we are now conscious, is ruled by natural law. I'll tell you, I know that. One time I went up to see Swami in his room. In the old days, he used to lean out of the window and beckon to me to come on up and let's talk. And so I said to him that time, Swami, you have to take care of all your schools, all of your students, people who yearn for God no matter where they are, not to mention taking care of the universe. So with all those things to do, Swami, how do you have time to sit here talking to the likes of me? So Swami said, Hislop, you don't understand. He said, it's not like that at all. He said, when you get into your car, and you turn the key and start the engine, then the engine runs by itself. You don't need to pay it any more attention. So that is the way with the universe. Swami turns the key, and the universe runs automatically without any attention from him. That's a clear statement that natural law runs the universe. How could it be more clear? And what is natural law in respect to persons? The principle law is not that of momentum, although gravity is perhaps to some extent. The principal law, natural law, that affects every one of us is the law of action and reaction. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. There is no effect without a prior cause. So whatever happens in this world in terms of our lives or in terms of the other aspects of nature is the result of some cause. Therefore, it's the progress of nature. Maybe the items are brought about by bad actions on our own part through our ignorance in past lives. But nevertheless, it's working itself out in terms of action and reaction. And yet we, in this particular moment, which is the only reality, say that it's happening to me. All this experience is my experience. My work, no matter what it may be. Swami says, that's wrong. So that's not you. You have no connection with that. That's the progress of nature, the process of nature. That doesn't mean that the objects in nature are complete illusion. They also are divine because they have their origin in you, and you project them out as the world. So they are real in the sense that they're part of your own consciousness. But they're impermanent, transient, changing all the time. And how can you hold to that which is impermanent, changing, and call it the truth? So then you have to dig deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until you come to that which never changes, which is the same in the beginning, the middle, and the end. Neither beginning, nor middle, or end, always, always the same. So what one has to do is to cultivate a bit of detachment, sir. A look at the daily events of your life as the process of nature. See if you aren't separate from that in terms of your awareness. Do what you have to do. Swami says, think good, do good, be good. You have to act in life according to your best intelligence. But you are free at any time to stop believing that that process of nature, that process of karma is you, because it's not you. You are God, divine. All that is the process of natural law in nature.